You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. From building referral ecosystems and creating authority content to learning from the deals that got away, this is where brokers get the tools to grow their pipeline, elevate their brand, and win the listings that matter most. Time for business broker growth.
On today's episode, I have Andy Cagnetta. He is the CEO at Trans World Business Advisors, the world's leading business brokerage firm. Andy, welcome to the Business Broker Growth Show.
I'm so happy to be here.
This is going to be fun. And a little bit of the info for anyone who doesn't happen to know who you are, doesn't happen to know Trans World. You have over 30 years experience. You've overseen thousands of successful business sales transactions. You turned your business into a franchise model with so many people around the world. 400 brokers, 200 plus franchises doing $1 billion in annual deal volume. You do so much in the community. You have your annual feed that you do to support you have your pasta dinner for the LifeNet for Families, where you've raised tons of money over the last 20 years. And so I'm super excited for you to be here because, again, you started in Florida, in brokerage, kind of created a lot of these things and then grew it to what it is. And so for the people who don't know who you are, why don't you share, you know, kind of how that started and the evolution of how you got here?
Yeah, well, I came to Florida as a buyer. I came to come down to buy business. I had bought and sold a small business up in Connecticut. I bought it for $45,000. 2 years later, me and my cousins sold it for $65,000. So I thought I was a genius. And I came down to Florida. My wife grew up down here. And so she demanded we move down, which wasn't too hard after it snows a few times up north. So we moved to Florida and I never knew what a business broker was. I never had met one before. I had sold my business by myself up in Florida, Connecticut, because I just didn't realize the service existed until I came to Florida. And there was a lot of business brokers down here. And I felt like I was in a used car sales room with most of them until I went to Transworld. And Transworld was owned by a fabulous couple, Don and Bonnie Parrish. They welcomed me in. They basically sat me down and said, "You don't know what you want. You don't know what, you know, and you don't know Florida at all," which is all true. They said, "Why don't you join us and you'll get the lay of the land and you'll decide what you want to do." And I thought that was a really good idea. And they said, "We think you'd be good at this." So I came to Transworld in 95 and I started, I sold 9 businesses my first year. And so I really loved this business. I never considered myself a good salesman. I think I'm more of a project manager. I try to help people do what they want to do. I'm not good at convincing people to do something they don't want to do. So 2 years into it, Don's full retirement kicked in at IBM. And so he wanted to sell. I bought the company in 97 and we started growing it. We were about 6 people at the time. We grew it to 10 offices in Florida, which we still own and operate. And we do about 400 deals here in Florida. And then we grew it. Then we decided, hey, how do we get to Charlotte? How do we get to Atlanta? And we looked into franchising. And as a model and as a industry, we knew nothing about it. So we realized, and I talk about this all the time, that out there in the world, eventually, if you want to grow a big business, you're going to need partners. And so we decided to partner with United Franchise Group, who most famously owns Signorama, several other brands. And we partnered with them 15 years ago. My partner Ray and I got together and we've built Transworld to 250 offices, many countries around the world, over 1,000 associates. And it's been a journey. So,
wow. So there's some things that you said, which I think is interesting, is the first one you said that you didn't even know what business broker was. You just bought, you had your business, then you sold it until you came to Florida. How often do you think that is the case with business owners who don't even know that there's a thing called a business broker, M&A advisor, intermediary?
Yeah, I still think the majority of people don't know what it is, even business owners. Now, I'll say in some places where business brokerage has become, quote unquote, very popular, and Florida being kind of like the belly of the beast, but Texas and other places, I think many business owners know what a business broker is, but they just don't understand the service. And if I had to speculate, and again, out of 100% of the businesses out there in the world, I think it's a wild over-exaggeration to think that 25% of them are handled by business brokers. That means 75% of businesses that either close, sell, transfer, do it without a business broker. So I don't think we have market penetration yet.
And you think that 25% is an overestimation? You think that's high?
I think it's an overestimation. And Florida, that may be the case because, again, we're very well organized in Florida. We have been for, you know, basically 50 years. But it's still very underutilized service.
Well, and it's interesting. And the reason I ask and it stands out is that every business broker I've spoken with always makes a comment about when they go to an event or networking or a conference or a trade show or anything like that, or at a party, at a barbecue. Nobody knows what they do or that it even existed. Right. And so I just wonder how much of that awareness and education is missing out there.
It is. And that's why things like this are so important. I mean, getting out there and helping business owners understand, you know, I sold my business in Connecticut. Again, I sold it for $65,000. I was probably making about $50,000 a year. Now, if anybody, all the business brokers are out there groaning, going, you just undersold it probably by at least one times, if not two. I didn't do a good job of selling my own business.
Yeah. And you know, when we look at the correlations, and we won't go down this rabbit hole, but, you know, people who try to sell their own house or try to sell something, and, you know, they think they understand what they're doing, but they don't. And then the business brokerage world, selling a business is so much more complicated. It's not like selling a used car where you could just go online and look at the value, because every business is so different.
A lot of times you only have one shot to really do it right. And it's tough to do it yourself, because you could literally, and we've seen it before, ruin their own business by not paying attention during the sale process.
Yeah, there's so much to it. Now, the second thing that you said that was interesting is that you came down to Florida, you found out what business brokers were, and it felt very used car salesperson. What was leading to that, or, you know, why did it feel that way? Was it just a bunch of people who were just trying to, you know, make money? Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, some of the brokers I ran into, which I eventually probably most of them I became friendly with later on in life as they, you know, grew older. But, you know, they were very, you know, back then there was, you know, business records were not kept well. And I think that has changed over time. And, you know, it was sort of a high pressure kind of like, hey, kid, buy it or leave me alone kind of thing. And there was really no empathy whatsoever that I didn't know what I was doing as a business buyer. So it just felt very impersonal. I think back to some of those brokers, some of them weren't dressed nicely. I mean, they're in shorts and Hawaiian shirts. And, you know, I showed up at Transworld, and Don, being from IBM, required shirts and ties. I mean, and probably that didn't go away here until almost right before the pandemic, and the pandemic just killed the tie world. But, but, you know, we were always, you know, had pride in what we did and wanted to be seen as professionals. So,
And you got to wonder too, because of the, you know, used car sales, like, picture, whenever you say that, When anyone says that in the sales world, like everyone can just imagine a picture of that, you know, plaid suit or maybe shorts and white shirt is where that was more prevalent pre-internet, pre-information age, where people could be more informed, had, you know, the feeling of more selection. Right now, somebody could pick and has a lot more, you know, options out there, or the illusion of options, versus before where it was like, you met a business broker, that's all you thought you could get. And then they could just do and treat you however they wanted. Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, back in the day, looking for businesses was looking at the want ads in the Sunday newspaper. Maybe during the week there were some ads, but most of it was Sunday. And so you were picking that, that was quote unquote the inventory you were looking at. And you didn't know if there was other inventory, which I quickly realized. That's why I visited so many business brokers, that these guys didn't know each other's listings very well. Again, that's changed over the years. And the ability to find a business for sale required you to buy the Sunday paper, which I used to buy several Sunday papers to try to figure out something that was local to me. It was an interesting time. I mean, Biz Buy Sell and, you know, any of the websites that you can go to for business brokers usually has the inventory on there. So yes, you have lots of choices and lots of information out there, and just things like comps are available now. It's just, it's a way different market.
Yeah. So let's talk about, because one of the things when you and I spoke before getting on here is you were talking about the old school mode where, you know, selling brokers don't accept a buying broker, don't want to, you know, share commissions, and then how that evolution became a thing and then became required, and, you know, kind of what you saw as that taking place in Florida. I think it's really important because I think there's, you know, a lot of value in essentially opening up the market to some essentially buyers brokers, right? Buyers agents coming in.
Yeah. I'll tell you a few things. Number one, you're stepping on the third rail of business brokerage, right?
Let's do it.
So, you know, I feel very strongly about co-brokerage. I think there needs to be an open marketplace. By the way, so I'll cover that in a second. But so in Florida, since the 1980s, for almost 50 years now, we have had a mandatory co-brokerage organization where we co-broke with it. And listen, it's not perfect. Do people not respond because they have other buyers and stuff like that? Oh, all kinds of shenanigans might go on. But for the most part, we co-broker here in Florida. We sell $1 billion of businesses in Florida almost every year. The number of transactions, probably in the thousands, have pale in comparison to anything else that's out there in the world. Any local organization, Texas, I'm not picking on Texas, I'm not picking on Colorado, California, but they don't co-broker. They don't, and their MLS has very few listings on it. And therefore, buyers do have to go to different brokerages to try to find what they want or need. And it's a very inefficient system. And as the taxi drivers found out who were had the exclusive at airports and didn't need to make it easier to call a cab, didn't make it nicer inside the cabs, didn't need to make it easier to pay. They found out what happens when technology and the consumer demands choice and demands ease of purchase. Yeah. And that is what's going to happen. It's not if, it's when. And business brokers have a chance. Mark my words out there, business brokers. You have the choice to be part of that or be run over.
And I can totally see that, right? I think the taxi analogy is perfect. I think everyone by now has experienced the ease and convenience and peace of mind that comes with, let's say, something like Uber or Lyft, where I know what I'm paying. I know I'm going to get there. I know I'm not going to get routed the long way around and taken for my money and, you know, whatever. Like, I know there's a way to complain if it's not good. And I think that's so important like you said, for brokers to understand that. And then I think the thing too, that's part of this that I know from reading your book, which we'll talk about at the end, is that also if the ease of finding them, the MLS system is not there and it's not listed, then you're not getting as many buyers, which means you're also not doing the best thing for those sellers. Like the seller's not having the right supply and demand, probably, and missing out on even more of a sales price.
Yes. But that is changing. And you know, BizBuySell, Axial, other platforms have made it possible for buyers to find the inventory. Now, it's just perhaps more inefficient than in Florida that they might have to deal with multiple brokers. And again, okay, that's getting easier too, because, you know, you don't have to call someone and get faxes and, you know, try to sign NDAs. All this stuff can happen automatically now. Sims get sent out. Meetings with sellers can happen via Zoom. It's gotten much more efficient. So I'm not jumping up and down saying, hey, you know, we're missing out on co-brokerage, because co-brokerage, actually, our statistics have come down. So we used to co-broke more than we used to. And I think, again, that's a function of the databases that we now all maintain, the Axial or Transworld or even Sunbelt or Murphy. We all have buyer databases, and BizBuySell as well. And we all have buyer databases where we can immediately send out notices that we have this new listing for sale. And there's so many buyers. Now, this may change when the buyer activity kind of calms down a little bit, but right now there are so many buyers that, you know, we put out a large plumbing electrical service. We got 220 something NDAs within the first couple of weeks. We had half a dozen or more meetings with the right sellers, and we had multiple offers for our seller to choose from. And that was all within a couple of weeks. We just listed a diner last week that we have a full price and terms offer from a billionaire that's coming from out of the country. I mean, the activity is so hot that the market is efficient despite itself. So
that makes sense. And so with all of that, then where are brokers still struggling? I know we're going to get into like the rapid fire marketing playbooks. I know you have some tips to share, but you know, where are brokers still struggling in this kind of a market?
Yeah. Well, so the hard part for brokers, and it's getting harder out there, is to harness all the data and continue to maintain a digital presence and harness all the things like AI. So that itself has become a job. And, you know, again, I think that's one of the benefits of joining someone like Transworld is, you know, we're working on that every single day. So you don't have to. Your job is to go out in the community, find the deals, get the deals done. Our job is to worry about the AI and the data and negotiating with the platforms and insurances and making sure our website and our social media programs are doing well. And, you know, all that stuff is just noise. I mean, running the business of a brokerage is become more difficult year after year and more expensive. So I think you'll continue to see consolidation out there in the world of brokers. But, you know, people still come in as independents, which is all good. But because there's still room out there, as we said before. If all the baby boomers are to come to the marketplace, actually scares me that there's not enough of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's going to be a ton of those businesses that, you know, I think more and more from what I hear and businesses that I've spoken with directly myself, where they know the future, the generation, the next generation doesn't want it, or they don't want to give it to them. And so the exit is the best way, right? And how do they exit with that legacy intact and get compensated for that instead of just shutting it down or losing all of it?
Yeah. The marketplace is good right now. And I want to make buyers and sellers feel good about one thing. And I think this is interesting, right? I don't think businesses sell that are overpriced, right? So I always tell buyers, listen, it's wildly competitive to buy a business, but you still don't have to overpay, which is, I think it's a unique thing in our business. You think about real estate, if you want to be in a certain neighborhood, the prices jump up and you're going to have to overpay. You're going to have to pay more than listing price. You know, with things like the SBA here in the United States, you're not going to be able to overpay because the SBA is not going to let you. And because there are valuation methodologies that are pretty well established and data out there that kind of brings all businesses into some sort of a zone. Now, I always tell buyers, listen, you're going to have to pay quote unquote top dollar, but you're not going to have to overpay. And really buying a business is still such a bargain, or as far as an investment is concerned. I think buyers can still feel good about going out there and buying businesses.
Yeah. And what if you had to say or guess, and you know, I know you're not in every transaction that Transworld does, but you know, you get a good sense of it, and I know you do a lot of speaking and you have your own podcast, is how much of that where buyers are not going to overpay, they're going to pay the reasonable right amount, right? Let's say the market price. And then getting something where there's a ton of potential because of those baby boomers who are, you know, implementing technology, don't have process, been doing the same thing for 30 years, have vendors on handshake agreements. Like what percentage do you think that opportunity is there versus businesses where it's running well, you're getting it, just don't screw it up?
Yeah, it's a little both, right? So I always tell people, listen, if you're going to go into a business, try not to do anything major in the first 6 months. You know, don't change the food on the menu. Don't change the signs. Don't change, you know, don't do anything to tip the world off that this is no longer the same owner or the same business. Because that's what you bought, right? You bought this goodwill. You don't know what is driving the goodwill. It could be the fact that this restaurant you bought looks like a greasy spoon and people love it because of the nostalgia. And all of a sudden you're going to come in there and modernize it and kill it. Right. So be careful of that. But then all those opportunities that you have, like, so we just sold a very famous restaurant here in Fort Lauderdale called Hot Dog Heaven. Been around. Guy ran it like it was the 1980s. Hysterical. I mean, old cash register, cash only, no DoorDash whatsoever. You know, the place certainly looked like a greasy spoon, but he didn't care, right? He'd been running it for 40 plus years. So we sold it to a guy, POS system, cleaned up the place, new grease trap, new digital menus, DoorDash. Sales are up almost two times. So, but kept the employees, kept the same menu, kept the same prices, which was hard, right? You know, but now starting to edge them up, DoorDash, you can make a little bit more money. So those kind of things, there's tons of opportunities out there for everybody who buys a business. You know, just be careful what you do when you go in.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I love that advice, the 6 month rule, just don't change anything. Nothing dramatic. Improve things that, you know, most customers aren't going to see or are going to find more convenient than the way it was always done, but don't change things.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to have to prove yourself anyway to your customers. We bought our pasta shop in Hartford from two little old ladies, you know, 70-year-old ladies. And now there's these two 20-year-old kids running this thing. No matter, we didn't change the recipes. We didn't change the way we cooked. We didn't change anything. But as far as the old guard who used to come there, the recipes changed, the food tasted different, and it didn't. I mean, we know. So, but, you know, we had to go out there and get our own following. So you're going to have to do a little of that as well.
Now, one thing that you mentioned was that the business broker in the transaction is managing and handling a lot of different things. You touched briefly on AI, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But how they're just managing lots of stuff and the tools, the technology, all the partners. In your book, you have a chapter talking about the business broker being a quarterback on the team. And I wonder, because what made me think about it is with tools and the technology and many brokers being left behind or not being a very good quarterback, their quarterback when the game used to be simple and there maybe was less players involved, you know, one CPA, one attorney, and how much is it grown? How complex is it now? And how is it like, if you want to be an NFL Super Bowl team, you know, and a quarterback that's leading that, it's completely different than high school quarterback, right? And playing the game.
Yeah, I guess things have somewhat changed. But I think as a business broker, the successful ones have the ability to manage issues, right? That's, you know, why do deals not close? Number one thing is unrealistic expectations. And whether that's the unrealistic expectations of the landlord, of the bank, of the attorneys, of the accountants, of the buyer, of the seller, of their spouses, it could be a myriad of people. The business broker as the quarterback has to recognize and call the play. And if there's something wrong, you know, and I'm managing a deal right now, which is a long story, but I'm managing a deal for a friend of mine who's, you know, they've been my friend for 20 plus years. And, you know, and I just like asked for the lease yesterday, you know, and they've been in the same location for 20 years and there's 9 lease addendums. So the bank wants the paperwork, right?
Yeah.
So they sent over this blank lease. This is the original lease. I'm like, that's not what the bank's looking for. The bank needs the paper trail
all the day one
to now. And, you know, the email back I get is, this is ridiculous. This is so complicated. I'm not doing that. And I have to call up and manage that and say, yes, you are, if you want to get to a closing. But having that quarterback, being able to quarterback those emotions, those expectations, and being able to change them is what makes a successful business broker. And it's about building that trust. And it's about building that, you know, reputation out there as an expert in buying and selling businesses.
How much of that comes with both experience in the world, experience as a business broker, and a mindset to also be able to predict the future going along with setting the expectations and knowing, like, if I need this, I'm going to need all of it, and kind of, you know, seeing around corners so you can always stay ahead of it.
Yeah, seeing around corners is important. I think it's you have to set the expectations, right? So, I'll tell people, a seller, that, you know, going through the SBA process with a buyer is going to be exhausting. And you're going to be like, I can't believe I have to give one more piece of document. And so just when you thought you didn't have to give more documents, you're going to have to give more documents. So I try to set that expectation in the beginning to tell buyers and sellers. And that's part of, you know, why we want to work with known quantities. That's why, you know, we talked about earlier getting the right team together and stuff. And that's, I talk about it in my book as well, having known quantities. And NFL coaches talk about that all the time. You know, they have a couple superstars that are head cases. They got a couple new draft picks that are wild cards and they're trying to figure it out. But they have this stable of players that they know are going to show up to practice, that they know what they can expect from them. And it's not, they're not flashy guys. They're the guys that are going to, and that's what, you know, you need to do as a business broker. You're taking the attorney that you've closed lots of deals with. You're going to the SBA bank that you know how to deal with them. And you could talk to the underwriters if there's something wrong. You know, you're going to the CPAs that you know how going to run the Q of E, because you're trying to take out those, you're trying to take out the variables, you know, the nightmares that are going to happen in a deal, because it is complicated.
If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business. And now back to the episode.
Yeah. And some of it is knowing the partners in the transaction, the known entities, the ones you can trust, and also the ones where you've built up enough of relationship and professional credibility where, you know, analogy could be there's beans in the jar. And so there's enough beans in the jar when you need help or you need a favor or you need something done, you know, there's that relationship that's been built over time. Right. That can then facilitate it. Like you said, when things go sideways, when something comes, it's not if, it's when in the kind of transactions. And then one last question before we get into the next segment, because I'm curious, because you said you found that you're a better project manager than a salesperson persuader, and you put yourself in the project manager bucket. Yet, funny enough, as you just said, that you're managing a transaction, which is project manager. Like once you get it, now the rest
right.
is. Although you could always argue that everything in life is sales, so you're always selling.
Yeah, sure.
Even through the transaction. For you, where did that make you a successful broker on the project manager side more than sales? Where do you see, you know, brokers needing to be the blend of both, you know, and maybe which is stronger, which is better? And then, you know, you can answer all this in once, which is then also like now you're running this and you evolved into running things very quickly. Is that, are you more of that business runner versus the business broker mode, and where do you see others that are kind of fit for one or the other?
Yeah, it's interesting. I see with my own franchisees too. Like I'll tackle the last part first, that there are people that are good at doing deals. And by the way, I don't think I'm great at doing deals. So I have people here that are way better than me. And then there are people that are good at running businesses. And a lot of times the two don't mix. Mm-hmm. And so I've been way more successful as a business runner, as I always tell people, my job is to provide my brokers the tools to succeed. So I'm forever chasing things like technology and chasing things like processing, chasing things like marketing to make it easier for them to do their jobs. And, you know, I'm there as a tool for them if, you know, needed an emergency. And that's part of building a community too. As far as being a good business broker and being a good deal maker, as far as, you know, you talked about some of the traits, you know, I think empathy is huge. I think being genuine and being, trustworthy, because, you know, first of all, it's a small world. It you know, out here in the business brokerage world. So I'm always, you know, I think if you talk to any of my competitors, I would hope that 97% of them don't have anything bad to say about me. And in fact, would tell them that I've supported their careers as well. Because I think it's a small little business brokerage world. Number two is, as far as out there in your community of buying, selling businesses, you're not going to do well by selling someone a business that doesn't fit them or that they shouldn't buy. So we've been, you know, known to step in and say, you know, this is not the right deal anymore. Everybody needs to go home, including the buyer. And, you know, I learned that early on from almost buying the wrong business down here in Florida, where somebody reached out to me and said, you're not seeing everything. And I like you and your wife. You're two nice people. And I don't want you to see you get in a bad situation. So I was kind of saved in the beginning, and I want to make sure that I'm doing that. Now, I've long ago stopped trying to predict who would do well in business. So I don't try to do that because I don't know what everybody wants or needs. It's like, would I buy a wave running business on the ocean and rent wave runners all day? No, not my thing, but it might be for that guy. Mm-hmm. And I watch someone who I completely underestimated would do well in that business. And they went in and opened 10 locations and did wildly well. So who am I, right?
Never know. You never know. But that's great. All right, let's get into the broker growth playbook rapid fire section. So this is the part here for listeners tuning in where I want you, Andy, to share some of the tips, some of the rapid fire things that will help business brokers grow their business, right? Some of it could be marketing, some of it could be technology, things that you've learned over all the years that you've done this, right. And what's fascinating and that I love about you too is your perspective. It's not just because you've been in the business a long time. It's because you've also seen a ton of brokers, right? And you've seen a ton of models in a ton of locations, because what works in Seattle might not work in Ohio, might not, you know, but you've seen it all. So when you're ready, let's start with the tips that you, you know, come to mind as you think about this. What have you got for number one?
Number one is, this is still a numbers game. If you're going to be a successful broker, you have to get out there. And if you're going to rely 100% on technology, it's probably not going to work for you. You have to get out there in the world and be present, because you need to touch as many people. Now, you can use technology to touch thousands of people, but at the end of the day, you're going to have to go out and meet them. And really, you know, if you're not going to build your own community, you have to build your own community, because people are going to check up on you, and they're going to call their accountants, and they're going to call their attorneys, and they're going to check up on you, and they're going to look at LinkedIn. So again, it's not just, it's a numbers game. You have to get out there.
Got it. And build, get out there, numbers game, grow the community. So not the numbers game as in, like, I need to send 10,000 emails a month to every business in my area, but a numbers community relationship building, shaking hands and kissing babies, and not just for the sake of biz dev, but also what I hear you saying is for relationships and also validation. When somebody says, hey, do you know, have you ever met Andy? What do you think of Andy? He wants to help me sell my business.
You have to become a trusted advisor.
And trusted
advisor. There are ways to do that out there in the community. And it's giving back first. You know, that's my other tip. You know, you want to go out there and give back.
Let's talk about that. So is getting out there and giving back in what mode? And again, I know you well enough, even though I don't know you very well, as I know you well enough to know that it's not the give to get strategy, which is if I give and I do stuff in the community, I'm going to get things. And so where is that? Where is that mode for you? Where is the heart for you as a tip?
I started my philanthropic career just because I wanted to help someone. I think, you know, a lot of times business brokers, that's what we're in the business to do. We're here to help people who want to do something. They want to buy a business. They want to sell a business. We're going to get that done for you. So when I met, you know, someone from the LifeNet for Families, which was the feeding program at the time, and they had a bad air conditioner, and they, you know, she was literally crying at lunch when we were having lunch together at a networking group, by the way, getting out there, numbers game. I piped up and I said, I'll help you. And she's like, how are you going to help me? I'm like, I don't know. We sold some air conditioner companies. I'll twist one of their arms, because now I'm friends with them. I'm going to stay in touch with them. We're going to get a new air conditioner for your charity. And we did. And I got to be on a board of directors and, you know, eventually became chairman, and eventually told everybody on the board, we have to do something to raise money, and started my pasta dinner. But, you know, and I didn't do that to get out there. I did it because we needed money at the charity, and this was a means to an end. And, but everything that it has brought to us, you know, we started with a few people. We started with about 30 people coming to that dinner. We raised, I think, $500. And, you know, the last few dinners have had 1,000 people. We've raised over $300,000 each time. And it's, you know, and just everything that has come from that, all that, you know, all the interviews on, with television stations, all the being asked to be on the United Way board, Junior Achievement board, the 100 CEOs of Broward County, all that came because I was taking a leadership position in the community.
Yeah. And I think the key underlying part is going back to something very early on we talked about, which is the used car mode, is that people can generally tell if you're not being authentic in the giving, if your intentions are different, if you're going to networking meetings and your intentions are just to scoop up all the referrals you can and then go on and move on, versus long-term relationship, planting seeds and playing the long game. And I love that, right? Like, I think that's so important to do that. And then it facilitates the numbers game, but in a very authentic long game. Let me just help and be present. And how do you do more of that?
Right. Yep.
Okay. Do you have a third one, a third tip, a third hack for business brokers?
Yeah.
it's all about marketing. And there's no, my third tip is there's no one good way to market yourself. Mm-hmm. There's good ways, cheap ways, you know, like everybody going out and putting notes on doors or shaking hands or going out and networking. But you have to understand that to build a business, you have to advertise and you have to spend money on advertising. And I think that people always ask me, why have you been successful? Others haven't. It's like, because I'm not a brokerage. I'm a business. We're a business. Mm-hmm. And we have to advertise and we have to tell people about our services. And there's no one good way to do that. I always tell people, we could buy a Super Bowl commercial. We should spend $10 million. It'll work. We'll get plenty of leads. The only question is will we get our $10 million back? The answer is probably no, because that's probably not the most efficient way for us to go out there to the marketplace. But there are better, efficient ways, even for agents. If you don't think you're in your own little business, you are. And the beautiful thing is that there are now opportunities for you to advertise that don't really cost anything. I mean, there's mm-hmm. cost, but for you to have a YouTube channel, for you to do podcasts, for you to have an Instagram, for you to have a Facebook page, you don't have to advertise. You could probably get better numbers and go out there and tweak the numbers game by buying advertising on those platforms, but you could really kind of do it on a ground level. So, you got to advertise.
Yeah. And I love it too, because one of the things you said that really stuck with me, and I've been around sales and marketing for a really long time, and marketing to drive leads and interest for sales teams, right? So not just branding, like let's just run commercials, but performance-based marketing. And one of the things you said was everything works in marketing. The question is, will you get your money back? Going back to your Super Bowl commercial, you could do it, but will you get your money back? And so everything works if you... Right. Play the long game, and depending on the ROI you need. And it's so true. And I think the biggest thing with all of that is what resonates the most marketing wise with somebody, what can they get behind and then continue on and do. And then here's the big thing. And I don't know what advice you have for this is where marketing falls off the map when a broker gets busy in a or multiple transactions and they stop planting seeds. And then next thing you know, those transactions are done and their farm is void of crops. And then now they're in this feast and famine mode.
That's why it's hard to do it by yourself. You really need partners. And so, joining a franchise or joining a brokerage is helpful in that, because they'll keep marketing for you. That's why I always tell people who join Transworld, like, let us help you. Let us, leverage all the things that we're giving you. Now, if you're by yourself, that's okay too. You just have to buy the advertising. You have to pay someone to be your social media manager. You have to pay someone. And there's plenty of ways to do that these days. God bless the internet, Fiverr and Upwork and all the ways that you can hire people on a contract basis to go do things for you. So, yeah. But again, and you got to decide what you want in your life, right? So I have three octogenarians that work for me, 80 plus year olds. They're here to enjoy this business. They want to have purpose. They want to do 3-4 deals a year maximum. They want to take care of their clients and get deals done for them and use their expertise. They're not looking like some of my young guys to do 20 or 30 deals a year and make themselves $1 million. That's not their gig. So you have to decide where you are in your life as a broker and what your plan's going to be to build that life. Because some people are like, hey, I have some people that want to continue to be a part of their family and be a provider. Mike Shea was one of those people. His wife works in a hospital. When she's gone out of work, she's not picking up the kids and she's not driving them to practice. And he did that. Now he chose that he was going to work at night and get things done and be able to balance those two things. But you got to decide what you want and then, put the plan together to get it.
I love it. I think that's great. All right. So let's shift. This segment is really fun too. And And I know we spoke about it. I think you have some good stories to share, but let's talk about the one that got away. If we talk about the lessons from a lost deal, which I'm sure you've seen yours, and then you've seen countless others for other brokers. And, you know, I know that these can be painful and emotional and challenges, and, you know, financially it sucks. I've talked to some brokers who have lost some deals and just really crushed them, you know, when their pipeline's falling apart. But I appreciate anything you can share that may help other brokers, you know, lessons that are in there, and business owners that are listening too, because, you know, they're the ones that are involved in that. So let's talk about what's a deal that got away.
So many deals out there in the world, so many deals, but I'll relay one. We had a hurricane shutter business for sale, very type A personality running the business. What we didn't realize was we weren't doing a good job of managing him in the process. And through the process, we eventually told him that, you know, he was so ingrained and so really he was everything in the business. He did not use the e-myth. He did not e-myth his business. Mm. He was the chief cook and bottle washer. And this was a business that was EBITDA of $1 million. And he had a wonderful acquirer. We eventually got to talk to that acquirer and said he was just so overwhelming and so demanding in this process that we just decided we didn't want to work with him. And so we were counseling him that he needed to take a step back in his business, which he did. And he wound up hiring a private equity group guy to help him run his business. That private equity group guy sold it himself. So we lost that deal out of our own advice. But, you know, we probably should have been more, we should have coached him earlier in the deal about how those buyers were going to expect him, because they wanted him to stay and build the company, but how they expected him to interact with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can imagine where that's tough. And for that type of personality, I can imagine where, you know, I don't know how well that advice would have gone. Would it have gone well early on, you think, versus that point in the transaction?
You know, it's hard. I mean, I always, you know, we have a saying, you want to be the first child, the second spouse, and the third broker. You know, so sometimes it's about being, you know, these sellers are going to go through an education process, and sometimes that's with a different broker. And then by the time they get to you, they understand the marketplace, they understand pricing, they understand structure, and they understand their place in the transaction, and that they need to use the professionals that we're going to bring to the table. So, you know, sometimes you're just not the broker who's sitting there when all that happens.
Yeah. And where I can imagine in that, you know, be the first child, the second spouse, and the third broker, which I absolutely love, is, you know, by the time you're the third broker, you're no longer the bad guy telling them the things they don't want to hear. And hopefully it's sunk in enough where now you're just the hero who just gets to cross the finish line without all the emotional damage.
Yep.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I think it's, you know, again, going to the expectations. Also, I think really understanding personalities and behaviors and people and their types and things like DISC and all those kind of attributes that then helps you understand, like, what are we going to get done with this person? How do I manage them? How do I coach them? What kind of feedback can I give them? And is it a good fit? Because, you know, in these transactions, these aren't simple and they're not quick. And so how much of it is you're also picking the seller and the type of person you actually want to help represent versus not? I mean, how many times does that come across where you meet a seller and you're just like, this is not a good fit?
We, you know, one of my brokers says, who's been with me for over 30 years, he says, I try to imagine whether or not that person's going to be in their chair 12 months from now. And if I can imagine that they'll do almost anything not to be in that chair, I'll take them at any price. I'll take them with any preconceived notions that they think they have, because I think I'm going to be able to change them within 12 months. The problem is, and that first example that I gave, that gentleman was probably about 50 years old when we had that conversation with him. And, you know, he was a young, spry entrepreneur. He didn't need to sell. You know,
no. So no, he didn't. He didn't need to. He wasn't in that phase of life where he was tired and burnt out and done. He was still charging hard. So, well, I love it. I appreciate you sharing all of that. And before we get into how people can to reach out to you and follow everything that you're doing, I just want to remind the audience, everyone tuning in, what we do here at Business Broker Growth. It's interesting, Andy, you were bringing up marketing and things like that, which is what we do. We help equip brokers with modern marketing systems that replace guesswork with growth. And really our goal is to help them become trusted advisors with the technology and things that you mentioned, which is fascinating and fun, and really leaving it so that the brokers out there can do what they do best, which is build relationships, help owners sell their businesses and close transactions. And so we do that with our Done For You programs and with our advising and our services. And so we love to help the brokers out there in the world so that they can do their mission of helping business owners exit. All right, Andy. So last thing before we get into your contact info, if you had to give brokers just one piece of advice to win more listings and referrals, things like that, what would it be?
Get educated. You know your business. I think it's really important. I think when I first started this business, I had a full head of hair, and I was young. I was, you know, 29 years old, and my big fear was that I was not going to be able to walk into a 60-something, 70-something-year-old business owner and tell them, "I'm the guy. I'm your answer. I'm this 29-year-old kid at the time." So I was smart enough to go out and, you know, as quickly as I could get a CBI from the IBBA. I did get my valuation credentials. I'm not sure everybody needs to do that, but I was very worried about not being able to understand. And I didn't have a huge accounting background, so the valuation credentials definitely helped me learn what to look for on balance sheets, what, you know, how to unwind the ways people were cheating on their taxes, and be able to talk to people in a way that they thought, you know, that they knew that I knew what I was talking about. So get educated.
Got it. I love it. I think that's so important. It's funny because early on, I was in the mortgage business when I was in my 20s, worked with a guy who was younger than me and looked a lot younger. He looked like a teenager, and he would literally put on glasses and wear a suit and try to look, you know, older in the mortgage business, because he's like, nobody's going to take me serious. And then he got to the point where he knew enough stuff and he didn't care, and he had the confidence, and he was like, I don't need to try to look older. I know my stuff. And so I think that's key. I love that. All right. So for people who want to follow you and connect, I know they can go on LinkedIn. They can find you, Andy Cagnetta, and it's C-A-G-N-E-T-T-A. So if you go to LinkedIn, this will all be in the show notes for anyone listening or watching this. But it's slash A Cagnetta on LinkedIn. Your website obviously is tworld.com, and your AC at tworld.com if anyone wants to email you. And then you have your YouTube channel, which you have the one that I find fun. I love is the at coffee with Cagnetta. Really like the conversation you had with your brother, which was fascinating and fun, kind of introduction to that kind of a casual conversation with you. So, what else? Any other ways people can find you? Any other things you're excited about out there that they can find online?
Yeah, no, I mean, those are the things we are going to. We're working on plans for the next pasta dinner. That was the other deal that got away, but it's another story for another day, for where we used to hold the pasta dinner at a large catering hall that was sold kind of around us that wound up being warehouses now. So we're looking for a new location, but we're excited to do that. It's andyspastadinner.com. So we'll be probably rolling that out next year and getting back to helping feed people. So.
Got it. And I mentioned it and alluded to it earlier, but your book, Closing the Deal, which is a great book focused on helping business owners understanding, you know, as a guide on how to avoid pitfalls and help successfully. It's also a great book. I enjoyed reading it, thinking about from the broker's perspective and also managing it as that quarterback, right? All the lessons you're giving to the owners there in the book is also great for anyone else that's facilitating it. So I appreciate you being here, Andy. Thank you for all that you've done for the brokerage world. I know that a lot of it is to help lift up and make it a professional organization. Yes, people can get licensed, get their certificates, but it doesn't make them professionals. And I think with the kind of stuff that you do and on the franchise model and you know, holding everyone to that standard, I think it's for the best. So I appreciate you being here, Andy, and sharing all this with the Business Broker Growth Show audience. And for everyone else, we appreciate you tuning in. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn, on YouTube. We have the podcast, obviously subscribe, and make sure to turn on the bell icon so that you get notifications when every episode comes out. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.